MDBK Talk, der Podcast vom Museum der Bildenden Künste Leipzig.
A call for the future, zero waste in everyday life, politics and the cultural industry. In this Walk the Talk, which takes place in the framework of the exhibition Zero Waste, we will speak with the participating artists and new Leipzig residents Khadija de Paula and Chico Togni, as well as with Sibylle Neumeier. She is an artist with focus on multidisciplinary research on health and cross-species relationships. Walk the Talk is a dialogical tour format in which two experts from different scientific fields exchange ideas with the audience on one of the exhibition teams and with reference to selected artworks in a moderated discussion. Due to the corona protective measures, unfortunately, only 5 people can take part. Therefore, we record all 4 Walk the Talks and make them available as MDBK Talk podcast episodes. I am Lena Fliesbach and I curated the exhibition Zero Waste at MDBK together with Hannah Beck-Managetta. Collectively with Hannes Glück, we will moderate this talk. Hannes Glück is philosopher, political scientist and also an active member of the repair café Café Kaputt in Leipzig. Welcome to MDBK Talk.
A warm welcome from my side. My name is Hannes Glück. I'm from the local repair initiative Café Kaputt, but with a background in philosophy and political science. I'm very excited with all of you, take this last and fourth Walk the Talk with the topic, A Call for the Future, Zero Waste in Everyday Life, Politics and Cultural Industry. So our task today is to sum up what this whole series and the exhibition has taught us and translate it to steps into the future. And like, okay, so we know a couple of things, or we get to know a couple of things seeing the exhibition, but what to do with this information, how to act in everyday life, how to act as an artist, how to act as someone working in the cultural industry, in the art world. So then I'll shortly introduce our three experts, two of which will be mainly talking. First, Sibylle Neumeier, who is a visual artist who investigates collaboratively and multidisciplinary human nature relationships, focusing on cross species concepts of health, care, and toxicity. She's been in several recent exhibitions around the world, and I'll hand over to her to say a few words on herself and how she's related to the topic of today.
Thank you, Hannes. Thank you, Hannah and Lena, for inviting me today. Welcome to the talk in walk number 4. I am, as Hannes already mentioned, an artist, but I am also a human. That's what we share. We are living on this planet as bodies that consume, that eat, that produce waste. And that's why I'm actually maybe not an expert in a specific discipline, but have the ability to look at the topic of this exhibition from the perspective of being an artist, thinking about how I myself participate in structures of producing waste and thinking about waste, reflecting on the cultural field as a practitioner, and on the other hand, thinking as a human about my own body and also, as well, very very important in my work, about the bodies of others, which means plants, animals, insects, but as well other humans. So I'm very excited about the discussion today.
For conducting her cross-disciplinary research, Sibylle Neumeier is currently hosted as a guest researcher at the Museum für Naturkunde Berlin and as art fellow at the Institute for Advanced Sustainability Studies, Potsdam.
And we have the pleasure to welcome Khadija de Paula and Chico Togni, who jumped in very, very spontaneously because, as you heard, our other expert couldn't come today. So the work of both of them is present in the exhibition. You'll see right when we come down. And I'd like to invite you to say just a few words how your work and your work life artwork is part of what we're talking about here.
Well, I guess to introduce ourselves, we are a duo of artists originally from Brazil, and I'm half Canadian also. And we have been working with found materials for over 15 years. And our practice is very much bringing our social concerns to our own lives in a way. So here in this installation, we have these posters, for example, that we have been making collages with our own garbage for the last 3 years in an ongoing project that we call How to Live with Less, where we question our level of consumption and we make these collages as a way of seeing how much waste we produce. Also, in a very nomadic way, which is not very zero waste, but is part of our contemporary circumstances. Well, and then we have also a series of objects that are all made with found materials, including the chairs that are made with recycled fabric. And so here in the exhibition, we have a number of different works that we have been producing in a few years. And the idea was to do a zero waste kitchen inside the museum because we do happenings and performances and activating or things and is part of our practice. And that ended up happening in the garden of GFZK, in a happening that involved also a mobile kitchen we built with Anna Linde. And
a local garden or a gardening project.
Yes. And so I guess the title of legendary zero waste kitchen ensemble and co means, I mean, it is quite legendary to be zero waste. Can we actually be zero waste? It's a bit of a fiction. But also, what are we cooking in our lives and putting in our bodies, as we said? And the ensemble and co are all the collaborations and connections that we developed through this time, and we ended up staying in Leipzig until now. And
yeah, thank you. Would you like to jump in directly?
Thank you. I'm actually very pleased to meet you. I'm a big fan of this work. I think it's very inspiring from many points of view. And now you mentioned the legendary zero waste kitchen and already point out that zero waste might be a fiction. So I actually was, when I visited this exhibition the first time, asking myself it could have a question mark in the end of the title, because that's actually the big question that we have to face. The problem is not to think like, can we really have the zero waste, but how to deal with the waste, to shift the notion of waste, and that's what you actually do. So I think waste is always defined in the eye of the beholder, and for a long time there has been the attitude that when something was not fulfilling the purpose that it was made for, it was considered as a trash. And I think the interesting aspect about zero waste is to think about, is it really trash or can it fulfill other purposes, and how to keep things activated, as we've been discussing before the talk started, activating matter, activating yourself, and also creating interactions with the material and other people.
Yeah, and I think that's something we can keep in mind throughout the exhibition and for our discussion later, that objects, like one way of coming to the result of zero waste is defining objects that were formerly considered as waste as no more waste because they are put to a new use. That would also maybe be a thing to keep in mind for later. Can we differentiate different degrees of usefulness of waste? Because like with all maxims, it's not about obeying it to the letter, because then you could define anything as useful in any way, even if it's just a little usefulness.
One thing that is important about the work that we talk a lot when we are doing is that this is still trash. This is our trash, and this is our trash also. And I don't know, we needed this wagon for transporting material. But this continue to be this in-between waste. Somehow everything is that is inside the museum is waste somehow. Some of the material, they are new materials. This is in between. They're not new, but they are not still in the trash. And this is one discussion that we have when we do the work. For example, this barbecue just uses metal, for example, found metal. And if we trash this in the correct recycling post, it's going to be correctly recycled. Or if we mix metal and rubber and everything, is a worse waste than it was before, you know? So this is another discussion that we have. For example, paper mixed with glue and plastic. So in somehow, we're kind of destroying even more the material, but it's in a between use of the material that has some use as art temporarily if we trash things again, you know? So this is one discussion that is inside of the work, maybe with the question mark for all of the works, because there is also a waste of energy to build stuff and to try to save material and not produce more waste, but it's also a waste of energy and belief to make it have a second chance or a sense of existing more, you know.
Actually, I would like to add to that. As you now say, sense, so maybe there's also a different notion of thinking about using and sense-making. And I think you could use the same material like the metal again and again to produce new metal and to repeat a structure about how our idea is how these materials could be used or should be used. But as I understood, you also bring these materials not only into the museum, but then back outside of the museum as like, you collaborated with the garden here to create a participatory event where you bring people together, where you create a community and you conduct discussions. So that is also a way of sense making. And maybe, we have to find ways of talking about different values of waste or material, waste as a material and waste as waste, but also in notions of values and sense-making and long-term shift of how we think about something and to use it.
Yeah, I think in everyday life, we all produce a lot of waste. So if we need a barbecue, for example, this is kind of a didactic part of the work that I like also to think about, is that this is a barbecue also, but it is also trash. So why produce, every day we produce, like, why this exists, you know? Why just let everybody enter? This was produced for nothing, you know? So it's part of the work to think about this, the useless rocks or the useful wagon. They're all connected to everyday life.
But if I can just add one thing about the sense making or the community and what it is for us, and I think in other works too, Well, we come from a background where a place where garbage is used in many different ways, because what is garbage in the north may not be garbage in the south. And, well, the economic cycle of how resources are produced and extracted and circled around is, well, I could go on and on. But we're very much inspired on how, when you have no resources, you make the best out of it. And you continue to use them until they go on and on and on. And I think with you and the work of the Repair Cafe
has... Yeah, that's what we're basically doing. Yeah.
A lot of that. And for, of course, we are very inspired by the poorness and misery and all the bad things that we've seen from where we come from. But being here is also like really a shift and a shock of how resources are dealt in a very different way, and they're very much more wasted.
Yeah, maybe that's another point we can keep in mind, that we are caught up in the processes and the normality we know, and like we need this different perspectives to collaboratively change what is.
As one of the artists of the exhibition, Nadine Fecht presents large-scale drawings with subtle inclusions of everyday city waste. She often uses such discarded and overlooked materials in her work. These remnants, which have become invisible to many in the urban space, are given a new function as part of the drawing, though their original shape and meaning are still legible. This can also be seen in the grip reinforcements from used plastic bags that make up her site-specific installation Net on the 16-meter-high terrace of the museum. With thousands of these grips joined together, the installation spills out across the floor like an undulating fishing net. Now we are standing in front of a work by Eliana Heredia. Her expansive installations employ everyday and ephemeral materials such as paper, cupcake, liners, caramel, mattress, foam rubber, or fake plants, which react to the effects of water, air, and temperature change. Our relationship to these familiar everyday objects, their physiochemical properties, and the consequences of their consumption only become apparent through their misappropriation and decontextualization.
We are seeing an installation that is made of sponges, gloves, plastic gloves, trash bags, and small plastic cups that seem to have some strange-looking liquid in it, some poisonous color, a very bright, almost neon red liquid in them. And the artist with this liquid relates to the notion of chemicals that are used within cleaning liquids. And so all of these materials that we are seeing here are daily household cleaning stuff. It's quite sculptural. It seems to be a landscape, but it also shows how fast these single daily life used objects accumulate over a course of time. All of these objects are also created as chains, so you can think of a temporal passage of time within using these objects one time and then the next one and the next one, and they accumulate. Yeah. For me, it's interesting. I deal with questions of health in relation to the environment. And if we think about the discussion of cleaning and hygiene, especially now in the pandemic of Corona, becomes very important to sterilize everything, to think about disinfection and keeping spaces clean. We actually produce even more trash by using all of these one-time use products, especially in the medical context. Gloves and also the masks we are wearing are produced and used in a very fast speed. And of course, this has an impact on the environment, and already a lot of studies reveal how much of these single-use products are now accumulating in the oceans, also in the urban space. It's hardly to go for a walk and not find a mask or some gloves lying on the floor. What is interesting about this work, it also kind of lets me think about cleaning itself as a practice, not only for reasons of creating a hygienic space, but also who is doing that. And as we're talking about trash and waste production on the expenses of others, also our notion of cleaning and keeping spaces clean on a closer view unveils some invisibilities about people that, for example, here in the institution, in the museum, do work in the night or in the early morning hours to clean the spaces for us, or people that are also bringing the trash away from the houses. This is also kind of a toxicity we can talk about in relation to waste, how we deal with labor and how we deal with who is dealing with these trash that we produce in our daily life.
Yeah, also, like, because in our everyday language, cleanliness is the opposite of waste, but it's related to waste in very complex ways, because cleaning produces waste, and like, yeah, also in the current pandemic, we have to balance the sensible hygiene things we do with producing more and more waste.
What's Sibyl saying about who is doing the work and how it's like very latent, like very important to think about how this is all very invisibilized. And I think also what Lena said about bringing a discussion or not. So this work, at the same time that it brings these questions and makes us think about all those things, it destroyed a lot of material. The gloves are no longer gloves. The plastic bags hopefully can be used again, and I think the sponges. But it's not about this work in particular, but as artists in the cultural sector, we do produce waste to think about things. And again, making sense of it. Is it, what is the value of it? Is it worth it? Why do we have this access, benefit, privilege of doing this? Is it because of the context? It is, in a way, very privileged to destroy material, to leave it unused, to, I don't know, to the amount of time, the space we used. So these are very important questions, I think, to all of us. Of why do we have all this access, and what is the meaning, and is it worth it? Or how can we also decelerate that and do it in a different way? And I think this is a very minimal example because it's so little, but when you get to the institutional level, then it becomes bigger and bigger and bigger.
Yeah. And that's certainly something we will come back at the end of our walk and talk about the exhibitions and the curator's effort to minimize the ecological impact of the exhibition as a whole. One comment on the work of art we're talking about, like all the materials used here will, after the end of the exhibition and the end of the life cycle of the work of art, will be put to use. So I don't know what the concrete plans are, but the sponges, this plastic bags, these gloves will be put to use afterwards. And also the poisonous looking liquid is just a symbolical non-poisonous liquid. So there's no toxins involved here. So maybe in walking by, we can just have a look on this object here in the middle, Wolf von Kries, Stastny's Erfindung, Stastny's invention, and it reenacts the invention of styrofoam. accidentally left in a, overnight, and then the next day Stastny, the inventor by accident of styrofoam, came back and saw this material extended to this form.
Wolf von Kries shows a few works in this exhibition. He has made the fundamental decision not to add any more to what is already available in abundance. And he works with used, apparently worthless and discarded materials. The work Kilt was made from moving blankets, which are hand-sewn together using the patchwork technique, one of the oldest traditions of recycling. Collected in various countries, the blankets themselves are made of recycled remnants of fabric and take on a new, sustainable value in this form. We see also three works of the photographic series Conglomerates, which documents snow that accumulates around the wheels of vehicles, which later falls back to the ground as a conglomerate of gasoline, soot, and frozen water. The over 60-meter-long Chinese chain lies on the floor of the museum in a meandering form. The artist found the first elements of his work, Chinese Chain, years ago on the edge of a highway in Beijing. Since then, he has been collecting the contents of his pockets, such as candy wrappers, admission cards, and subway tickets, and linking it together around paper clips at the end of the day to continue the chain.
So everyday waste, metro tickets, and what else do we see? I see a barcode. I see a piece of bubble gum packaging, and so I think this piece of work brings us close to an artistic reflection on everyday life waste production that is sometimes very hard to avoid. You entering this exhibition couldn't refuse to get a printed ticket, for example, or like if you want to use the public transport, you need to stamp your ticket.
I was immediately appealed by these both works, the Kilt and the Chain, because both of them are made from leftover materials from something that we call waste, but then they are translated in something very aesthetic. And it's really interesting from the perspective of an artist that the transformation of the material and the translation by using it in a very different way, or also worshipping it or collecting it, creates an aesthetic experience that maybe is also, besides all these other works that throw a critical perspective on how we deal with trash or some futuristic imagination. What I like about this one is very much that aesthetics is a way of relating to things and to questions and to objects. And when you come from far, you see this appealing, colorful, yeah, very fragile thing on the floor. It reminds me of my childhood. It reminds me of things that I desired to have as a child. And when you come close, you see it's like things that you know from the daily life. Some old tickets, chewing gum papers, maybe something from a cigarette box. And they are just collected day by day. And it's always what he finds in his pockets as leftover from the day. So again, in this work, you find some temporality, but also you find the notion of collecting. And when you think about trash accumulating, you can also think about collecting and accumulation in a positive way. So collecting can also be expressed desires. So that's what I like about this work. And when we look at the patchwork here, the kilt, doing kilts is actually a very old tradition that is community building, where people together sit down and create blankets for the community by stitching together small pieces of fabric, telling each other stories, and very often also embroidering small images of these stories that they want to be translated for the next generation. And I think it's really interesting because this shows also how we as humans and people and artists could build collectives, and how worshipping a notion of the small artifacts and leftover from the daily life can, if we think them as a collective, be something valuable again and be something that, when I look at this, it's a blanket. It also gives me a feeling that there's some protection in the future. If we manage to collect the small bits and pieces and stitch something new from them together, then this is maybe also an approach to be protected in the future, where we are surrounded by things that we would, in a first glimpse, regard as a trash. So I think they're both very, very positive works, actually.
Yeah, I think that both works are perhaps they have the closest approach to our practice also, which is this of the collection of the everyday. Yes, the obsession of bringing it to another level, to creating some kind of sense, aesthetical sense, and treating it as something precious and elevating it within this, giving another value to, like, okay, like, this is, what is this worth, right? The ticket, like, and it's also about the experience that every little piece of garbage brings and so on. So I think it's much more close to our practice, and our posters are also made of this little bits and pieces of everyday garbage. And when I see the pictures framed, I also think about how we have exhibited these posters in other circumstances within frames that create even more garbage. And that brings again to the question of how do you take garbage away from the everyday context and elevate it to art or like photographs, how toxic they are, you know? So I think it's, in the exhibition, there are different artists that work in different ways, and Wolf and us, I think we have this very close approach to actually trying to change something with our bodies and our practice. But also, one thing that strikes us about the quilt is that for us in Brazil, those blankets, they're not used for moving, they're used for homeless people. And that's another level of what it means if here in the north is something for moving objects, perhaps somewhere else it's something that will actually keep a human body warm. So, and it's already a recycled, low quality, cheap. So anyway, it's brings a lot of questions indeed.
Yeah, I think that's what I thought is so poetic about it, because it now gives the feeling it's for humans and it's something protective. And now, as you mentioned, of course, it is for some people, this is a blanket. And actually it's very, very important to consider about that we take some materials for granted being there, and for other people, they are something they would need to survive. And I think thinking about a future that helps us to be a community that bridges between the problem of using materials as objects and pure matter for fulfilling some superficial task or protecting other objects, going back to thinking about material that creates communities and protects communities and protects people and other beings.
And part of that is also like the aesthetics and their functionality, right? Even though we collect all those little precious papers and try to elevate it, in a way, the posters, they are still useless, while the objects, they have like a particular functionality. Like they work as a chair, they work as a wagon, as a barbecue. And this will still work as a blanket, but I think as artists, at least we try to question ourselves, well, if we're destroying it even more, if we're mixing with another material, if we're putting glue on it, it needs to have some kind of function. Otherwise, it may have a higher aesthetic value, but it will have, at the end, a lower social value because we're destroying it.
It's the most cheap fabric that you can have. If you see the process of making these blankets, I don't know if someone already saw, it's like sewing again the rest of a fabric production. So basically it's the same material that we used in the jeans, the dark plates. It's jeans and fabric. And the other one is real wool. It's lamb wool, made with the same process, but with very expensive organic product. So, but in South America, this is the cheapest kind of fabric that you can have. And also, if you transform in a quilt, it's like a fancy, cheapest fabric, which is also a big contrast. That is nice. It's put a lot of work in a shitty material.
But in a way, it's good that you remember that both our chairs and the floor of our installation and this quilt, they're made of the same. It's the residue of textile. So here in the blankets, they're put together and sewn together. And as you said, they come from different places of the world and they're processed differently. But the material that we use specifically is from a textile company in Denmark that recycles the material and brings to a high-end by binding it with plastic, because that's the only way to make it rigid again. So that's again a question of like, what is the value of so much recycling?
All right, so we'll move on to Bianca Kennedy and the Swan Collective.
The work is called Animalia Sum, I am animal, and it deals with the question of the future of food in relation to replace the meat production by eating insects. And the Swan Collective, together with Bianca Kennedy, created a virtual reality where you are traveling or following a journey of a bug through the different aspects of this question: how do we imagine the future of food? And you start being a bug that is eaten by a human, but later on, I will not talk too much about it because it's also nice to be surprised sometimes. You will shift the perspective and be a human that is engaging with the question which kind of nutritions you would get out of a specific insect, or how would you feel like eating it, as well some interspecies dialogues that will happen during the VR. And I highly recommend you to take the time and do it. It's kind of fun also, but it's also challenging. It's a bit creepy. It brings you to some uncanny moments. And I think that makes the work really interesting because it challenges our maybe cultural conditioned imagination of what is food, and also it challenges how we think about food on a planet that has more and more scarce resources and that has also an increasing population that wants to eat.
Yeah, and that also makes the talk much more down to earth, everyday life related. So like, would you personally switch your diet to insects, like once a week, maybe to reduce your ecological footprint? What would that be an option? Like, maybe hands up who would try?
A visitor now asked if the question is related to the people who eat plant-based. What are the insects replacing? Are they replacing anything?
They are replacing protein, animal protein. Yeah. So if you're vegan or vegetarian, of course, you don't need to say, I want to try it. Yeah.
Yeah, but that's also something we could discuss. Like, I don't know the exact data for the production conditions of insects, but I could imagine that if you, on an industrial scale, produce insect protein, that the ecological footprint of that would be superior to the one of soy, for example. Mm-hmm. So it would also be a question for vegans like me.
Well, I'm actually curious to hear from Sibyl about it, but I just want to bring a provocation that we're often talking about changing our diets, changing the protein base from animal to insect, which has also a judgment of the value of life of mammals and insects. And one thing that we rarely talk about is the decrease. I mean, if you eat no protein at all, or if maybe if we don't reproduce as humans and we don't leave a legacy of a larger increasing population that will eat anything, like they will just simply be less people. And I would like to hear what you have to say about, you were talking about humanism and how we value our lives from different species.
Yeah, for me this work was very interesting because I also researched on the same topic. I'm doing a long-term project about human-insect relationships. And actually, I think it's really very important to have a work like this here in this exhibition. That we're not only thinking about waste, it's something that we find on the streets or in the garbage, but also thinking about the food production and how closely interlinked our food production, economy, ecology, and also our relationship to other species. And thinking about what you said about the nutritions, of course, it's very important to think about locality of food and also about cultural impact, but also being situated in a specific surrounding, in a specific climate, where a diversity of food is always related to what you eat and to where you are. And talking about, like, for example, the SDGs, the Sustainable Development Goals, that are now placed to think about how we can transform to a more sustainable future. It's very important to really look closely at this question of food production, because you cannot say there is a planetary instruction how and what to eat, but it's so interlinked with what your body needs, what your interaction with your microbiome is, what you can digest, and how your surrounding also challenges your body. So at some places, for example, you can also not grow much vegetable, so the nutrition or the food is based on meat. But in other places, there's very easy to access vegetables. And this is also thinking about sustainability as well, because you could say, well, we all just eat vegetables, but then we have this whole infrastructure of logistics and transporting things, and why should indigenous people in the Arctic Circle eat a kiwi that is shipped from New Zealand because it has so much vitamin C in it, if they already managed over the millennia to develop a knowledge to ferment a specific kind of meat in a way that is not only sustainable and conserved without being put in a fridge that would use energy, but also very much fulfills the needs that the body has in this specific environment. And as you already mentioned, there's a hierarchy in how we think about animals. And then, for example, there is the food industry that has this domesticated animals that we eat, but then we have other domesticated animals we would never think about eating, because we are having built a relationship to them. And then thinking about insects, it's something that would be much lower in the hierarchy. And it's also addressed in the work very nicely, because the insects starting a revolt. And another point I think is very interesting to think about is what you say about the CO2 footprint, for example. There has been a lot of calculations made already how much the CO2 footprint would be less than the one in the meat production. But I also think it's very important to think about then the logistics that comes not only to the production, but also to how to bring food to different places. And also to think about the big question mark, do we really need this mass food production, which in itself causes a lot of problems and a lot of toxicity. Mass food production always is related to bringing a lot of animals on a very small place together. This means that infections, for example, within the animals are spread very fast. This means that you would use antibiotics to maintain the health of these animals, and also insects have microbes and microorganisms in their bodies that could be a hazard for each other. And then we put these antibiotics in the animal as well in the environment, and this has also a long-term effect on our surroundings. So I think it's not only a question about which animal would we prefer to eat or which animal has more value than the other one, but also thinking about this whole logistics and economy around it that creates mass production and creates a mass consumption. So I think this is a very, very important work within the exhibition because it unveils so many layers of this intersection of food production, politics, and economy.
One thing that we discussed about this work here with another friend, also a curator, is, for example, this idea of saving the planet, for example. A lot of times when we talk about saving the planet, we are talking about saving our own assets because the planet is going to stay, even with or without humans. And so the carbon print math is a very complex math to make, like, seriously. You know, there is a lot of people researching that very seriously. For example, walking here or taking the paper from the gift shop, or, you know, all this math is a very complex math if you want to take it from the exhibition level or the society level or the city level, you know. And, yeah, I think this is another question mark.
And I think that's a very important thing you're pointing to. It's not strictly math. It's not about only an optimization process. You can't definitely calculate which way of behavior is the ultimate best. And there are things like thumb rules, like if you go vegan in some, that'll improve your footprint, but then it depends where the vegetables you eat come from, what is grown locally. Also, I think the example of mass production is a very good one because in some aspects, mass production might be more efficient than little farmers doing producing for a local market. But efficiency isn't everything. And so you have to balance and process all this information. And then you got another layer on top that one of the resources you got to deal with is your time and your attention. And so, just a little personal story. At some point in my life, I just decided to switch my nutrition to vegan, not because I'm in all aspects agreeing on that it's in every single case the best, but just because I'm saving attention and time. If I make this decision, I go somewhere and I choose the vegan menu, and I got attention for other things to think about. And so, like this, when we're trying to process all the information we got here and all the data and all the means of informing ourselves into everyday behavior, we are dependent on a mixture of different thumb rules that we criticize and that evolve over time.
And for everyone who would like to try an insect, I brought some. So if you want, you can also, you don't need to eat them, but you can touch them or smell them or look at them. Because I think we are talking about in a very abstract way about eating insects right now. And I brought some grasshoppers. They are very nice when you roast them, my brother said. You don't need to eat it. It's more like seeing it and also maybe smelling it.
I'm curious to see, but yeah, oh yeah, okay.
The big ones.
Yeah, I still have, like, I still can't eat animals, but I don't know.
Me neither.
Like, I really like that. It's in my brain.
For those who would like to try, what's the preparation you recommend? Like fry it in a pan?
They should be fried in a pan with some salt, some chili, maybe garlic.
Sounds good.
They're just dry.
They are just dry right now, exactly.
Where did he bring them from?
Well, I bought them for my research, so accidentally I already had them home and I thought it's nice to bring them today as we talk so abstract about this topic, because I'm also a person who very much relates to other species, and I think insects are fascinating. They are so diverse, they are so creative, and they manage to deal with the most extraordinary situations, and thinking about humans then is quite boring, to be honest.
And also they outnumber us by many magnitudes.
Yeah, the biomass of insects is immense, and also the role they play to really maintain our planet is so important. And I think, you know, this notion of putting a hierarchy on different species, on how we want to use them or what they would do as a service for us, is actually a crucial point to work on as a community, as a culture, but also as a single person. To really change the planet.
A visitor noted that we know that from indigenous cultures. They have a stronger relationship to nature. They always ask the nature. They have this awareness, she says.
You're not only an artist, but also a scientist. I forgot to mention that you got this...
I would say researcher.
Yeah, researcher, like a guest at Museum für Naturkunde at the moment, Sibylle, and at the... Institute for Advanced Sustainability Studies in Potsdam. And so that's where you got all this information from.
Yeah, I mean, I work a lot with scientists and researchers, and it's actually very valuable to work at the intersection of these two institutes, because these questions of, transformation of how things or problems are tackled with, or the thinking about sustainability is very important for me. But then when I started my research, I came to a point where I realized that thinking about all these discourses from a purely anthropocentric perspective would not lead to a really holistic engagement with all these issues. So it's really nice for me to think also with biologists and people that... have learned to listen to animals and plants.
So we urgently need to switch to the last work we are discussing. Andreas Greiner calculated the impact, the ecological impact of the whole exhibition, Zero Waste, with different models. You can see all the complicated charts and figures here and the formula. And so it's part of the effort to make visible the ecological impact of what we're seeing here, of the whole exhibition, and also on an exemplary level of the cultural industry in whole. And I'll shortly hand over to the curators to say a few words on their struggle for transparency and compensation.
Yes, organizing an exhibition is already a decision for using resources, for creating an ecological footprint, but we try to hold this footprint as low as possible. Andrea's work gave us not only the possibility to make it transparent, but also to try to compensate it by cooperating with the initiative Baumstarke Stadt Leipzig, which is locally planting trees and sustaining their cultivation throughout the city. 100% of the proceeds from the exhibition catalog are dedicated to planting trees under the patronage of Zero Waste. One visitor asked the question if there are already some things or thoughts in the curatorial process that we curators keep on doing in further exhibitions. And the answer is yes, we will. Regardless of the topic of future exhibitions, we want to inspire others to also take care of the ecological footprint. For example, by deciding for less travels and transports, especially from abroad, choosing a sustainable exhibition display that will be reused from the museum afterwards, renting material from other cultural institutions and spending leftovers to initiatives like Trash Galore in Leipzig, who are collecting different material and technique and give it to other social and cultural projects. Already in projects beforehand, we were reusing packaging, for example, and now there is the research in the art world how we can create sustainable artwork packaging, which is really great. It is all about making decisions and compromising. This is not always easy, but also for Zero Waste, we decided to produce a catalog in order to have something that stays and as an informational tool. But we selected a small format and ecological friendly paper and colors for the print.
So, yeah, I think what I heard from all the different aspects we were pointing at, it's like it's an ongoing process, and it's try and failure and try again. And so, like, we were talking about the everyday level of consumption, of nutrition, of like all the consumption decisions you make. We were talking about the art production process that can keep a zero waste maxim in mind. We were talking about the museum, and like it's recurring on all these levels that there is not the one perfect way, but there are individual decisions by consumers, by artists, by curators, and they can be exemplary. And like as artists, as curators, you maybe have a broader reach than like the person from the street. And with that comes an ethical aspect of like you always have to balance, make decisions, and so yeah. What I gather, it's an ongoing process, and we will make failures, and it won't be perfect. So the zero and the zero waste is always like an aim we can't reach, but we should continue trying. And in the same sense, just a little advertisement, like the repair cafe working at Café Kaputt in Leipzig, but like just look it up, repair cafe and your city. There's almost everywhere an initiative like that where you have a chance to repair your stuff instead of throwing it away and buying new stuff. You wanted to say.
I'll try to be brief, but I just think in closing this question about future, we often think about better, improved, keeping doing so that we'll get there, we'll not get there. And when we talk about sustainability, it often comes with the idea of development. And I'm a big advocate for less, develop less, do less. And I think we're all trying to do that. And there are various standards. And I think we really need to lower our standards and ask ourselves, why should we do things if they're not going so well anyway? So before we repeat and reproduce and do things again, we should maybe just don't. Yeah. I prefer not to.
Maybe the best choice is not to buy the best product, but to buy no product at all.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to the Walk the Talk today. You can listen to all four Walk the Talks that took place as part of the Zero Waste exhibition as MDBK Talk podcast episodes. We will keep you updated about the Zero Waste exhibition on our Instagram account, Zero Waste Exhibition.